So, good to see everybody tonight. I know that each and every one of you are very worthy ambassadors for the cause of Christ, as a matter of fact. I know I feel comfortable here. Welcome. If you'll turn to the screen here, as always, I've got a couple of slides to show you about Jericho. Obviously, you've been reading this week, I'm sure all of you, from the book of Joshua, and of course, reading there then in those early chapters about his conquest. As the leader of the army of Israel of that city as they are entering the promised land. When I snapped this picture, I was looking just due east at the mountains of Moab. If you look right here, you can see just that little stripe of blue. This is the lowest place on earth. That is the north shore of the Dead Sea. And so Jericho is just maybe a mile or two off to your left and out of sight right there. The length of the Dead Sea stretches off to the right. And there are the plains of Moab. It's here this book of Deuteronomy all takes place. It's there that Moses prepares the people for their entrance into that promised land, which all begins, as we'll be seeing and already read, in the book of Joshua. Now, this morning, though, I had a similar picture up, and Dean back there pointed out the glorious beauty that we have by comparison. That is an awfully hot land in the summertime. It is, you know, terribly barren in some respects. However, it's not really all that bad all the time. Now, this is when you turn from the previous picture and look to the left. What runs alongside the mountains that the Jews will then be climbing as they head off into that promised land, going uphill toward Jerusalem, the rest of, you know, the hills of Israel, which, once you get up there, are quite beautiful. There's a lot of rainfall. You get snow even in Jerusalem itself sometimes in the winter. They had a big snowfall here recently. And so, you know, from antiquity, it has been a desirable place to live, but a desirable place to live only in the wintertime. In the summer, it's just oppressively awful. And so, you know, those who were kind of stuck there, you know, really did have to suffer, but it was almost like a resort area, if you will, throughout antiquity, as I'll show you in just a moment. From the air, this is the tell, the mound, of ancient Jericho itself, which is contender for the oldest city on earth, and been occupied, you know, going back thousands and thousands of years, millenniums in fact. And you'll note here, if you compare some of the other structures in the area, that it's not very big. And I want to point out, as we started tonight, when you read about the cities in Israel, you read about an attack on a city, bear in mind that their definition of cities is a bit different from ours. Spread ahead and turn that on. Now, in that, what they would do is they would count the surrounding area where people since antiquity would be living in their individual homes and working their individual fields and taking care of their vineyards, you know, their orchards and that sort of thing. But then there was a walled area, a fortification, that we would think of as being, you know, more like a military base. And so that's what this represents. They didn't build the double walls of Jericho, you know, around miles and miles and miles of area. But in this city, we'll have more to say about this on Wednesday night, there were storehouses, granaries that had been built, caches of weapons, a heavily fortified wall. And then when any invaders showed up, what would all the people be forced to do? Well, they'd have to abandon their homes and their fields, and then they would retreat into this fortification from which they would fight their battles and hopefully, you know, be able to defend the area in which they live. So when you think city, don't think, you know, kind of that wide open sprawling thing that we call Springfield or Eugene. It's really not like that. I mean, it is like that. But when it gets to talking about an attack on a city, it's just this fortified area that is under consideration at that time. Now, what I did want to mention, these are the remains that have been uncovered of Herod the Great's palace in Jericho. It's quite an important archaeological site, although not a lot of it has been exposed
But you do see that it was well thought out, and that, you know, even the bricks have been turned, you know, so that they're diamond shaped, you know, is the way they've been laid rather than squared flat. And Herod loved Jericho and would go down there for the winters to an elaborate palace that he had, for in the winter, it's a wonderful place to be. It would be warmer and it would be drier than what was up there on the highlands. As a matter of fact, it'll be here in this palace that Herod the Great will die. So this man, who has built up so much of Israel, who is renowned as a great engineer and a builder, had several palaces. Masada is very famous. He had a palace, you know, that was in Jerusalem itself. But the one that he really liked and that he died in was this one right here in the city of Jericho itself, and outside those fortified walls that we were just talking about. Now, bring all this up, of course, Jericho is the focus of the book of Joshua, at least in the early going. And so tonight we're going to spend a little time trying to just fill in around the edges about this man. There are people in history, brethren, who just really, as we'll learn, hear the phrase in other parts of the Bible, stand in the breach. They're there when God needs them. And they play pivotal roles in world history, certainly in biblical history, because they were ready for the job. One of the first five sermons that I ever preached, and it might have been actually the very first one, I'm not sure about it, when I looked all the way back, the first efforts I ever made, had a sermon I called, Would God Have Chosen You? And it was just simply a brief review of a number of biblical characters. Now, Job is one. He's an example of a certain thing in biblical history. Immediately it comes to mind for you. Noah is another man who's an example of a certain and amazing moment, you know, in history. Moses was one that I had, in the sermon right there. Individuals that play pivotal roles because they were ready for it, because they prepared themselves for it. So the title of the sermon was, Would God Have Chosen You? If God needed a man to demonstrate to everybody that people will serve God, even if it's painful, even if the price is high, even if you don't get an immediate reward, they will serve God purely out of the love and appreciation that they have for their Creator. Would God have chosen you to be Job, to be subjected to that test, to take up that responsibility, and then to be down, you know, written down in history as the one prime example that Satan is wrong, that people are only in it for what they can get out of it, and that all service of God is a selfish thing because God gives so liberally to those whom He loves. That proposition is not true. The service of God is not selfish. It's not out of fear. We serve God because we love Him, and a perfect love does what to fear? 1 John, perfect love casts out fear. We're not serving God because we're desperately terrified of, you know, what He might do to us in eternity if we don't, so that we're serving Him only because the consequences are too awful to, you know, contemplate. We're serving God because we recognize who He is, His glory, His majesty, His wisdom, and while we are aware and concerned about that final judgment, we, hopefully all of us, like Job, will serve God regardless. Joshua, I believe, is a similar kind of a man. And he's going to play an astonishing role. He is handpicked by God Himself. And more than one occasion in the Scripture, we are told this. It is God who's telling Moses, I want Joshua. You're going to do thus and such for him. But did you know that his name is mentioned over 200 times in the Bible? And they're not all in the book that bears his name. There is, of course, the book of Joshua, which we mentioned so many times already this evening. His name appears in there a whole lot, but that's not the only place where Joshua appears. His significance is useful to God in other ways as well. And for instance, he is, and that's where I'd like to start now this evening, you know, a major player, if you will, in the book of Hebrews. Now, obviously, as we're doing our study back in Joshua in the book itself, Hebrews is not a part of that study.
So tonight I thought we'd introduce this and see the end from the beginning, as sometimes in Scripture God is also described. He knows the end from the beginning. Well, thanks to Hebrews, we can also see why Joshua's book is so important. What it is going to mean millenniums later when the Messiah comes. How his life, his behaviors, especially in the book of Joshua, are going to be used by God as an object lesson and a doctrinal point in an elaborate argument that you find in Hebrews chapters 3 and 4.
Now you see I've been cherry-picking just a couple of verses right here, so we're not going to read the entire context.
But hopefully by now you've opened up the Hebrew letter, chapter 3. Have a look at verse 11. This is the first of quite a few quotations in the Hebrew letter in this chapter from Psalm 95. Psalm 95 appears in Hebrews 3, verses 7 through 12. Another verse from that psalm is repeated at verse 15 in chapter 3. Psalm 95, 11 is in chapter 4, verse 3, and again in verse 4. 95, that psalm, verses 7 and 8, is in verse 7, also of chapter 4. So you can see, Psalm 95 is really the heart and soul of chapters 3 and 4 in Hebrews. But as you look at chapter 3 and verse 11, this part of Psalm 95 that God's going to build an argument on or a case on in verse 11 is that he had sworn in his wrath, they shall not enter my rest.
Who are they? They, Psalm 95, they're not going to enter into my rest. The people who died in the wilderness. The people who failed to have the faith to enter that promised land when God first would have given it to them, but they were afraid of how big the occupants of that land already were.
They were terrified of battle. They didn't think they could go up against fortified cities. So 10 of the 12 of the spies came back with a bad report. Remember all that from Numbers 13 and 14 here a couple of weeks ago. So many years later, in Psalm 95, God is, through the inspired author there, saying that infuriated him to the degree that he took an oath, God did, and he swore in anger that they would not enter his rest, God's rest. What does that term mean, God's rest? Skipping to verses 18 and 19 now in chapter 3. To whom did he swear that they should not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? And so we see they were not able to enter because of unbelief.
Now, written, I freely grant, they could not enter the land flowing with milk and honey. They did not enter the promised land. Their courses fell in the wilderness. We all understand that. But is that how the Hebrew writer is referring to these people? No. They were not allowed to enter into something else also. The land is just a part of this. They were not allowed, because God swore in his wrath, to enter into his rest, into God's rest.
Now, looking at chapter 4, we are going to need to pick up the thread in Hebrews 4 and read verses 3 through 11. We who have believed enter that rest. This is a long time after Joshua. This is probably 1,500 years after Joshua. We who have believed is now a reference to Christians and their faith. We who have believed enter that rest. What's the Hebrew letter? It's to the people in Jerusalem and in Israel already. It's not talking about going into a promised land. It's entering into some other kind of a condition, relationship, or circumstance that's called a rest. And then it's defined in verse 3 at the very end. They shall not enter my rest, although his, that's God's works, were finished from the foundation of the world.
That's tremendously important. How long did God's rest last? And the rest that these people are not able to enter into, this freedom from labor, how long was it intended to last?
And is it talking about big grapes? Nice countryside? Great weather? You know, in the promised land, important as those things are, going back to Genesis 12, they were promised to Abraham and his descendants. Is that what's in view here? No. It is a rest, as verse 3 points out, that will be like God's, and his rest has continued since the foundation of the world. Now, Greg's here tonight. He and I met for a second time with those three teenagers I told you about in the bulletin this morning. He read in the bulletin. He and I met at my house, and we'll continue to meet on Saturdays, probably for 6 or 7 weeks to come, at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, the 3 18-year-old Seventh-day Adventists. And a little leader of the group, a young man named Reuben, he tried to convince us that this passage was talking about the Sabbath rest and how Christians ought to keep it. Okay? Why? Because he's been taught, you know, all his life, he grew up in an Adventist home, that when you read about a rest in the Bible, it's resting on Saturday. It's not working on Saturday. And this shows that the Christians were doing that. Now, look carefully at chapter 4, verse 3, and ask yourself if that's what we're talking about here. Did God rest on the seventh day, and then he went right back to work on the eighth day and had to rest on the 14th day? Then he went to work on the 15th day, and he had to rest on the... Is God resting every 7 days? Is he creating in between for 6 days? It's not what he's talking about at all. When he rested, it was from the foundation of the world and from then on. As a matter of fact, I think Greg will confirm this. Now, I actually noticed this young man when I began to point out what I'm going to share with you here, you know, this evening as well. He actually had kind of a stunned deer in the headlights look on his face. And I believe, truly, for the first time he was realizing, oh, the rest that's being talked about here is not repetitive. It's not cyclical. It's not alternating in between 6 days, you know, over and over and over and over again. It endured since the foundation of the world. Now, we go to verse 4. He has thus said somewhere concerning the seventh, the day, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. He said, don't do any creative work again after that. Verse 5, and again in this passage, they shall not enter into that. Whatever this rest is that God did, they're not going to enter into that. There's more said about it. Verse 6, since therefore it remains for some to enter it. So I pointed out to this young man, if you're teaching and believe that Christians were keeping a Sabbath every 7 days by not leaving their home, going for a hike, building a fire, you know, they were staying home, how's that going to fit? In verse 6, it remains for some to enter into it. You're teaching they've been doing it for 35 years that they were Christians and all their lives before that too. How can it remain for them to enter into it? They've been doing it. They are doing it. You know, it just doesn't fit. Those who formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience. We're back to Moses, Exodus through Deuteronomy. He again fixes a certain day, verse 7, today, saying, through David, after so long a time, just as has been said before, here's the what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th time, Psalm 95 is mentioned. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. Here he is in verse 8. For if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. There remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And this young man, great confidence, good for him. He's got a lot of courage. He's honest to heart. You know, only 18 years of age, he's going out, knocking on doors, meeting strangers to try and persuade them to accept what he believes is the truth. Honorable. In fact, maybe embarrassingly so for some of us who haven't quite got the same sort of courage. But he thinks verse 9 is talking about Saturdays. Well, Joshua was keeping the Saturdays back then. didn't remain for them to start doing something like that. He gave them that. So how can it be said there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God? Well, here it is in verse 10. The one who has entered his rest, God's rest, has himself also rested from his works. How? At the end of verse 10. As God did from his. And when God rested from his works on that seventh day, did he continue his rest on the eighth day? My young Adventist said, yeah, he did. I said, okay, did he continue resting on the ninth day? Yeah, he did. 10, 11, and you could see it in his eyes. Never thought about it like that. When God rested from his creative work, did he ever create on, you know, the eighth day or any other day after that again? No. He created it once, and then he what? Rested. From all his works. From the foundation of the world. And when those people disobeyed him, were faithless, he said, those Sabbath keepers that had already been keeping the Sabbath in the wilderness, he's saying to them, you will never enter my rest. You got the Sabbath, but you'll never enter my rest. You will never know a place that is so of permanent contentment and peace and release from labor, from work, from hardship, from effort. You will never have that. So, brethren, they died in the wilderness and didn't get into the promised land. That's true enough. But, brethren, they didn't go to heaven. They did not enter into God's permanent eternal reward. This is what they lost. Pardon me. Okay. So then, with a few minutes to remain, what I want us to see is Joshua, I believe, never dreamed that a chapter in the Hebrew letter 1,500 years later would bear his name, that it would reference his place in God's history, that he would be a part of a grand argument that had to do with heaven and forever being free from the travails of this earth. I don't think he could possibly have had an inkling of such a thing. But he was such a man that God could then use him not just for the time that he was in, but as we will see, for succeeding generations, and then also as a great doctrinal argument about eternity and being obedient to God's will in our time so that we can enter into his eternal rest. Never again to have to suffer the vicissitudes and efforts of this law. Now, if you'll come back with me to Exodus, we certainly are not going to have enough time to be reading all of these passages, most of which you will have already read in the course of our Wednesday night studies anyway. But you'll see what they're about, and remember, those of you that are with us in these studies, you know, about them, so we're just going to reference them, then we'll bring this lesson to a close. In Exodus chapter 17, if you would please, just kind of start there at verse 8, and you scan ahead and just remind yourself of what took place there. Amalek came and fought, and Moses immediately turns to whom for help? This is the first time that Joshua's name ever appears in the Bible. It is the first time we find out that this man has work to do. This man is chosen to go out and fight against Amalek. Moses says, you're the guy that I want to lead this army. And you'll remember then, that famous time in history, the man that's got to do all the hard work, the man who's going to war and not peace, the man who's leading all the Israelites in this battle against the Amalekites, is Joshua. Meanwhile, apparently up on a hill overseeing all of this, what's Moses doing? He's holding out his hands. And we got Aaron and Hur, what are they doing when Moses gets tired? You know, holding them up, you know, propping them up. But the man that's doing all the work is where? Down below, fighting this battle and losing to some extent, you know, when Moses' arms are not uplifted. So in 12, Moses' hands were heavy. He took a stone, put it under him. He sat on it. Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other. His hands were steady until the sunset. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Now, there's a miraculous element in this. There's a divine action that's taking place in this. There are powers at play that are greater than just military might. But all the while, what was Joshua's job? Fight. Blood was shed. Soldiers died. It was war. And it was his task to go and fight. And God's purposes with Moses, God's miraculous powers that are on display here, are God's business. What did Moses immediately turn to Joshua for? Lead those people into battle. Why? Because Moses knew this guy. So if you'll skip now in Exodus to chapter 24, it might have been kind of easy actually to pass over this without too much thought or notice as we were going through our reading earlier. But please note in Exodus 24, and again, you can start your reading at verse 12. Going to read down to the end of the chapter right there. But in verse 13, what is Joshua called? He is the what of Moses. See, he was already Moses' servant. And Moses went up to the mountain of God. Wait here for us until we return to you. Verse 15. Moses went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord rested on Sinai. The cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. At the end of verse 18, how long is Moses on the mountain? 40 days, 40 nights. Who was on the mountain? Look again at verse 13. So Moses arose with Joshua his servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. Why was Joshua mentioned? And then Moses went up. Did he leave Joshua behind? Have a look at this passage, brethren. In chapter 32 of the book of Exodus, there's a very interesting thing to consider here. In verse 15, Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets which were written on both sides, written on one side and on the other. This is 40 days later, isn't it? Tablets were God's work. The writing was God's writing engraved on the tablets. And when Joshua heard the sound of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there's a sound of war in the camp. But he said, it's not the sound of the cry of triumph, nor is it the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing I hear. Came about as soon as Moses came near the camp. He saw the calf, the dancing, his anger burned through the tablets, shattered them at the foot of the mountain, took the calf, burned it, ground it, scattered it, and made them drink it. Who appears to have been there right with him this whole time? Joshua. Now, brethren, that's the servant of Moses, whom Moses called, and God as well. Now, they go up the mountain, and then they come down the mountain. Now, I don't know if he was touching Moses. I don't know if he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. I don't know if, like Jesus with the disciples, that he went a stone's throw beyond Joshua. But when you put these passages together, Joshua is the faithful servant of Moses, and at least they both started up that mountain. Joshua was at a higher elevation than everybody else was. Whether or not he's at the top in the midst of the fire and smoke and hears the voice of God every word like Moses did, I'm not sure. But he went up, and then what did he do? He came down. And he has not been in that camp because he's as surprised as Moses is. What are they doing down there? Worshiping this calf. He has not been in that camp for those 40 days. He is Moses' right-hand man because he's been prepared for the moment, for the service, for the responsibility, for the work. His rest, an eternal one, will come later. But now, he has work to do. Now we leave Exodus and come on over to the book of Numbers. You can already see it on the board there, or on the screen rather, but in Numbers chapter 11, again, it's so easy in our reading to just, you know, not actually stop to take note and calculate and realize, you know, what the verses are saying. I find myself I have trouble with this. It's so easy to just abandon Joshua. You know, it's Moses, 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 like there was never anybody else. But in Numbers chapter 11 at verse 27, a young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Then Joshua the son of Nun, the attendant of Moses, from what? From his youth, answered and said, Moses, my Lord, restrain them. But Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit upon them. Then Moses returned to camp, he and the elders, and I'm presuming here, and Joshua too. This Joshua is the ever-present, from his youth up, servant of Moses, who to some elevation ascended Sinai with him and came back down and watched him destroy the tablets. That's the young man that will grow into the shoes of the general of Israel. That's the young man that is chosen to lead the people against Amalek, who precedes Sihon and Og as they're coming up the eastern shores of the Dead Sea to eventually enter that land. This is the young man who will have the book named after him, every bit of which is the story of endless war in his life, as the promised land is conquered under his leadership for the 12 tribes of Israel. He's like the phantom, you know, of the opera. It's so easy for us to just not realize he was always there, brethren, in the background. And Moses leaned on him. Moses used him. Moses needed him. Moses depended on this young man from his youth up. Now, you remember in Numbers chapter 13, we talked about that at some great length. I'm not even going to turn over there now. He is the spy that was selected from the tribe of Ephraim, brought back, you know, with Caleb, the positive report. In Numbers 27, he was chosen specifically by God to replace Moses. You know about that. We've already read that. I do want to have a quick look at Deuteronomy chapter 34, though. In our last week's reading, and in the very last chapter of Deuteronomy, the very last words that have any reference to Moses, historically that is, of course, and tell us about his death, we find this in the last verses of Deuteronomy, starting at verse 9. Joshua the son of Nun was what? He was filled with the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him, as God had ordered, and the sons of Israel listened to him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. For all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh, all his servants and all his land, for all the mighty power and all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. Brethren, there'll never be another guy like Moses. But who saw it all from his youth up? Joshua. Filled now, somehow supernaturally, via God's command, and Moses' laying on of hands, something we read about in our New Testament, this young man is endowed then with a divine wisdom that will be guiding him as he accepts the mantle of responsibility that now falls from Moses' shoulders as he dies upon Mount Nebo and is buried where no man knows. Joshua chapter 24, the most famous thing that is known about this man in the last chapter of his book, of course, is his famous contest and challenge, choose you this day whom you will serve. So we're not going to spend any time with that. We're seeing that in another week. but we'll close tonight with Judges chapter 2. So let's move over now into the book after the one that is named after Joshua. Let's come to Judges chapter 2, and now in verses 7 through 9, take note, brethren, and ask yourself, would God have chosen me? In chapter 2, verse 7, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord, which he had done for Israel. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. And they will bury him in his tribal land of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. Okay? Now, brethren, what is here just sort of hinted at is specifically stated in several other places in the Old Testament that we'll eventually come to. But it is this. Those who stand in the gate, those who prepared themselves so that they could be used, depended upon, so that they could be spent in the service of their God. Those who have prepared themselves have profound influence in their day, in their time, while they live. And then, the scripture tells us time and again, often, for another full generation after they got it, that influence goes on and on. We read this about parents as well as generals and prophets. That influence continues down through time. There's at least two generations that are mentioned right here. And now the lesson for this evening is over. Dare stand like Joshua, we think. We know he's important. We know there's a book named after him. But how many of us, brethren, think, and particularly want some of you younger ones to think about this, how many of you from your youth consciously decide, I do want to be like Joshua? And I don't mean leading an army against Amalek, circling the city of Jericho and watching the walls collapse, going out to do battle and bring all the land of Israel, that promised land, into the possession, you know, of the Jews. To be there present on Mount Sinai with Moses, you know, all those kinds of things. You know, they're great, they're grand, they're great things. But how many of you, at a very young age, decide, I would like to be a servant of the Lord like Joshua was from my youth up? I don't want to wait until, you know, I'm in my mid-20s and I'm the grand general, you know, and I'm doing all these great things. I just want to be right there next to Moses. Right there next, in this context then, to our elders, to our deacons, to me as the preacher, to the others that are the teachers and obvious leaders who are prepared for the service of God in our time. Are you one of them? So in my lesson tonight, particularly, brethren, not to these old fogies, it's too late for them anyway. Reaching out to you younger ones. Joshua apparently made up his mind. And he got going at it. Make up your mind. Decide that I will be ready when God calls me. Should God call me, I won't stand, you know, and say, oh, I don't know, and I can't, and I'm afraid. But to be prepared year after year after year. So that when the opportunity arises and you realize it's my turn, there's the gap, there's the need, God needs me, then choose whom you will serve. As for me and my house, this is the end of his life, brethren. He's 110 when he says that. Why can he say, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord? Because as for him, before he ever had a house after him, before he ever thought about marrying anybody, before he ever fathered a son or a daughter, he was there with Moses getting ready. This is the Joshua that we usually just don't know about. The lifetime of service from the early years. Stand like Joshua, and you'll be used by God like he was. Appreciate your attention. As always, we offer an invitation to those of you who may need help in prayer or Bible study. Perhaps one of our younger ones or some other in this assembly is choosing this day to serve the Lord by being baptized into Christ for the forgiveness of your sins, ready to serve a risen Savior. If so, let it be known. Come speak with me, please, as we now stand and sing.